Let's keep on caring. Let's keep on sharing with
Bill Jenkins.
It's Saturday night, and for the next 3 hours, we're here to expand you. We're here to talk about the frontiers of your life. We're here to talk about some things that will be a part of your life. Mind-boggling, and to most of you, unreal. But they are real. You want to come along? Our guest tonight, John C. Bedini. Who's John Bedini? He'll be a very important man in your life. Also with him is Stephen Wirth. Who's Stephen Wirth? Well, he is with John Bedini. I call them the Technobrats. A little bit later, joining us will be Thomas E. Bearden. Now, these men all have something in common, and that is you. But more importantly, I'm looking at something here right now. I am looking at a free energy machine. It's just sitting there, going on its own, and it is creating energy. That's just one of them. And there is another one. Now, these are laboratory experimental devices. They'll be in a museum someplace, I suppose. But you will have one in your house that is providing you with all of the energy you can ever use. You will be disconnected from the Department of Water and Power of Southern California Edison. You won't need them anymore because of these men who are going to be on the show with us tonight. John, welcome to Open Mind, and thank you for coming down.
Well, thank you, Bill. I just have to say that it's been a real pleasure to be on this show with you. And I'm here tonight to open everybody's mind.
Well, I appreciate that. And the guy with you there?
Oh, yeah.
This is the mystical magician when it comes to taking an idea and making it into a piece of hardware.
Mm-hmm. One of the best men in the field that I've found.
He argues with you a lot.
Well, he argues with me, but a lot of times he's right.
He understands what a gravity field is, what a stress scalar wave is, and he understands a lot of these things that they don't understand at Caltech and UCLA and TRW and all of these other
things. More than that, it's to have somebody who can visualize this machine in his mind and then put the mechanical part of it together. The electronics is nothing.
There is this huge machine that he has in his shop.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's bigger than that whale that was in the Sacramento River.
That's right. That's under construction.
And he programs its little computer. It's a big computer. I guess you could go to the moon with that computer that's on that machine. And then it comes out with this intricate little piece of machinery. You know, in goes a bunch of stuff, and out comes this magnificent thing. Right. The two work together like the Bobbsey twins.
All ground out parts.
Yeah.
Within 1/10, usually, on all the tolerances.
John, we have talked here in the last year. I think your first show with me was in September of last year, September 17th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Free energy. I am looking at it right here in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
What is that thing? You know what it looks like? It was made by my grandson in the backyard. It's a bunch of sticks and some little wires all stuck together.
That's true. This particular machine here is what I call the pendulum-type generator. And this type of machine can gather power in the middle of the night, and it can also lose power during the day. But it can never run down. Its output is always more than what its input is, because there's a very special little motor there driving that machine.
Well, you talk about a special little motor. Let me describe it. It looks like a spool of thread.
That's right.
Period.
That's right.
There's a little magnet in it.
No, there's no magnet in it.
There's not a magnet in it? There's something
in it. No, it's a solid piece of iron, and this is triggered on by this pendulum, and it only requires thousands of an amp to give it a push instead of volts, as we're used to.
Now, on the other side of the swing of the pendulum, on both sides, you have some coils there. On the bottom of the pendulum itself is a little magnet that looks like a horseshoe thing. Can we go ahead and play horseshoes
that's,
with that?
That's right. It's one monopole magnet, and we could stop this, and you can have a better look at it. You can see it's one pole.
Oh, you've changed the magnet.
That's right.
The
because
last time,
we
yeah.
found out that by having a monopole generator in free energy situations, the efficiency is much higher.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so if we start this monopole generator, and you can hear it click away,
mm-hmm.
okay, what happens is it has to pass two output coils, which are conventional generating coils. That pulse is then returned back to the battery while the motor is off. But the motor, remember, is drawing thousands of a watt.
Okay.
So this whole instrument is running on less than 1 watt of power here in the studio.
And how much is it producing?
It is producing 24 watts of output power.
All right. Now, we have a motor, or we have a pendulum,
mm-hmm.
that's running on less than a watt.
That's right.
And it's producing 24 watts.
That's right, Bill. And you see,
Where's it getting the energy?
Okay. Now, we're going to go a little bit into that. The energy is derived because of the motor's efficiency, number one. And number two, the earth adds to that. You see, in all our textbooks, we've been taught that the pendulum is one instrument which will measure the earth's spin.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as the earth spins on axis, the pendulum would change direction. In that direction, since we don't have a way for this pendulum to change direction, what we do is aid the pendulum in movement back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as the earth turns. So at certain hours of the night, that pendulum will go up to 90 degrees, which means the output power is increasing even more. The earth adds to it.
Now, if we were to put meters on those few wires that you have there, would we be able to see that output?
No, because let me explain to you what the problem is in conventional meters. First of all, they do not detect spikes. In other words, they do not detect the spikes, and the meter cannot read instantaneously that peak, not even a true RMS meter. Okay?
All right.
So, what we have here is a generator that will produce output power no matter what the situation is.
Well, are you saying then that we're creating a kind of energy here that it is difficult, if not impossible, for most of the conventional instrumentality to read?
Yes, Bill, that's exactly what we're saying. The meters which we have today do not respond fast enough to this current spike.
Well, I don't want you to sell snake oil here. If I can't check that, how can I trust what you're telling me?
You can check that by putting a meter on the battery,
mm-hmm.
which will tell you that the battery's not going downward.
Well, I should probably describe this pendulum here. It's three sticks that are kind of built up in a pyramid with a pendulum now on it going back and forth. It's driving me crazy, but it's going to do that. Right?
All right.
It's going to do that all night long.
Bill, let's...
And you have a battery pack that is hooked into what you call the motor, which looks like a spool to me.
Bill, I brought another instrument with me, which I'm going to set up right at this time.
Okay.
And I'm going to let you see for yourself exactly what's going to happen. And
right.
this is something that's based upon this principle. And I do want you to see this thing, and I'm going to throw it into the charge condition where I'm going to send these spikes back to the battery. And if that's true, the wheel should speed up.
It will speed up. And while you're doing that, we will be finding Tom Bearden, who is somewhere. Michael Kelly, who has one of our engineers here who doesn't believe all of this. Michael, come on in. I want you to look at these devices. Now, I've been talking to the engineers here at KABC, and these guys all know their electronics very well. They keep ours shining and going all of the time. What we do is... A violation of a lot of their physical laws and properties that they work by. So the engineers here are very interested. So, Michael, you're a part of the show.
Michael, come here just for a second. I want you to see something as an engineer, okay?
Now, this is... he didn't know he was going to do this.
Here's a compass. I want you to check out that wheel and tell me that there's a north... No, don't start the wheel. Just check the polarity of what those magnets are. And make sure that there's not one in the wheel that's not indifferent. Okay, they're all the same polarity, right?
Let me turn on that microphone over there, Mike, so you can get on, because you're a guest on the show, so you don't have to worry about your...
Okay, Mike, what I'm going to do...
They're all consistent.
...is I'm going to hook up this battery, okay? And these two are generator outputs, okay? And what I want to do is I want to hook up this battery. If you wish to get a meter, you're more than welcome to do that. I'm going to hook up the battery. Here's the positive. Here's the negative. Now, notice that there's no movement in the device whatsoever, but you have all the pulse. So what we do with this type of energy device is, if we want full power out without drawing anything out of the battery whatsoever, we have a little light that's equivalent to what the wattage draw of this particular motor is. Do you also notice that there's only one pole on this motor? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what it appears to be anyway.
Okay.
Sure.
Now, what I want you to do is put this switch down in the start position. Just push the switch down. Okay, and give this a spin towards you. Now, this is at a constant current. If you had a meter on there right now, it would be at a constant current, okay? Now, what I want you to do is put this into the charge position, push the switch up. And if this speeds up, it must mean that the battery is getting more energy. Go ahead.
Slight increase there, yeah.
Well, let it go.
And getting faster.
And getting faster.
So we'll just continue to let that device run, Bill.
All right. It's a monopole.
About 4 hours.
Okay.
Michael Kelly, engineer. Is that defining...
Is it speeding up?
...your idea of what energy should be?
Well, I'm the wrong guy to really be asking about all this, Bill, but it appears to be
now,
as simple as it looks.
Let's take some energy
working.
From that, okay?
We have an impromptu demonstration going on.
I have a little bulb here that's a number 47 bulb, which is equivalent... By the way, this motor right here is running on about 0.128 milliamps. And see, it has plenty of torque here. And what I want to do is take it out of the charge condition, because I want to supply power now somewhere else without any drain here. Okay? So I take it out, and I supply my power to where I want. That meanwhile, that keeps running. Now, if you put this switch back into the charge condition, I will send it back to the battery.
Interesting.
And it will speed back up.
Just amazing, Bill. I have to apologize to Mike Kelly, who is our engineer here tonight, who keeps us going. He did not know that he was going to have to come in here and look at some electronics.
There's a very unique thing there. That motor is being driven by all the same type of poles.
Well, not only that, it's spinning a 7-pound weight.
Pretty good, sir.
Yeah, it's pulling 7 pounds worth of mass for less than 1 watt of input power. And still speeding up.
Mike's eyes are as big as a saucer over there.
It's okay.
I'm convinced on this part of it. Anyway.
You're convinced there, are you?
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Well, guys, I want you to put on your earphones, because we have another guy on the phone here. Mr. Thomas E. Bearden, who is one of the more advanced theoretical physicists in the world. Tom, welcome aboard.
Hello, Bill. Nice to be back with you.
Where did we find you tonight?
Well, I'm sitting someplace in Dallas, Texas.
In Dallas?
I'm not sure just exactly where, but I'm sitting someplace in Dallas, Texas.
Well, we're sitting at a studio in Los Angeles. We've got free energy devices going crazy here in front of us. And, of course, your friend and mine, John Bedini, and Steve Worth are here.
Oh, boy.
The technobrats have descended upon us in full measure.
If you've got those two guys loose again, no telling what's happening.
Well, they drove me down here tonight. We got here in 20 minutes. I don't know whether we went through some sort of a time frame or whatever, but with those two, anything can happen. Have we got free energy, Tom?
I have not been able to see that device. I was listening very intently there. I just came on the line a while back, and I was listening to the description there as if they were winding it up. As best I understand what you've got, with all the poles of same polarity, I would say you've got a very good chance of having it right there. It's got to be it.
Well, we have two different ones. We have this rector set-looking pendulum that is not about to stop swinging.
Yes.
And I have seen it swing for hours, in fact. It will drive you crazy with that little pum, pum, pum that it does. But it never stops. And, well, it does stop if you stop it. Well, no, it's not stopping there. Well, it's on the motor right now, so it's kind of wiggling on top of the little motor that's in the middle.
Yeah, well, as I understand, you were taking some energy out, too, at least occasionally there.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's the criterion. If you throw energy out of the system and you keep going, sooner or later you've got to say that you've gotten that energy from a new kind of source, that it's not the conventional sources that are going on. When we say free energy, you know, we really mean that there is some hidden sources. There are some hidden sources in the vacuum. They're like hidden rivers that can be tapped. Normal motors and normal generators do not tap them, but it is possible to build motors and generators that do.
Well,
and we're saying that you build a special paddle wheel, and you build a special river. You have to make the river. You make the dam for the river, so to speak. And once the dam is made and the river's flowing, you have to furnish just a tiny bit of energy to maintain the dam, but you don't have to build it again from scratch. And then you have to have a special paddle wheel that'll go in the flow and take that and turn that into shaft power. When you do that, what you've really done is in terms of relativity, you've bent space-time, and you're using gravitational field energy, and that's exactly what it sounds like you're doing right there.
Well, this is a form of gravity engineering we're looking
at. See, all energy, in the extended sense, all fields come from or directly associated with the curving of space-time. You might say gravitational energy in the general or extended sense. And so all the other energy comes from that as some subset of that. And then really, if you talk about a more obscure kind of energy, you just build a more obscure kind of gravitational field in the theory. And so we can boil it all down to say there's one master kind of field source or energy source, and for want of a better term, we call that gravitational field, because there are many, many things that warp space-time. It's not just a single field. It's a conglomeration of a whole bunch of things. And that's what we call gravitational field. And if you get one part or two parts or all of that working, yes, when you warp space-time locally, you've done something that our textbooks have assumed you can't do. And if you do warp space-time locally, we already rigorously know that you can violate conservation of energy locally, where you're at. We're not saying for the whole universe. We're saying where you are. Just like if you stick a paddle wheel in a river, if you only consider the paddle wheel, don't consider the river, you seem to have violated conservation of energy. Of course, there's a source there. In this case, you've created a more subtle source and a more subtle paddle wheel, but it's really at base root level. It's no more complicated than putting a paddle wheel in the river. It's complicated than being able to do it and to think those new thoughts. But in principle, it's the same principle as a paddle wheel in the river.
Well, what we're trying to say, Tom, it seems to me, when we say the term free energy, you know, we can look at John Bedini's devices, these things that he and Stephen Wirth have made, and they are many and varied. There are a number of them now.
Yes.
That we no longer have to burn fossil fuel to get energy.
That's true.
We no longer have to build dams to back up rivers to get water to turn turbines, which will power generators.
That's correct.
That is a thing of the past. That we can build machines now that will sit on this table here at KABC that will provide you with energy. And there is no pollution going into the air. We're not spending a dime for oil. We can have it in our home.
That's true. And let me make a comment on, in general on this that clarifies some things. When Einstein wrote the theory of general relativity, when he first wrote it, the only thing they knew that would actually bend or warp space-time very much was a huge collection of mass, something like a sun or a star. And so they assumed that there'd never be any kind of way that you could bend space-time locally enough to make any difference or to even measure or detect hardly. So that he made an assumption when he developed the theory that locally you would never have general relativity at all. Instead, locally, it would be special relativity. In other words, in special relativity, all your conservation laws are upheld. You have conservation of energy rigorously. You have conservation of charge, conservation of momentum, and so forth. And so what is written in the ordinary theory of general relativity, as it's taught in all the universities today, is a highly restricted form of the true general relativity. It assumes that there's not much disturbance at all where we are, and all the disturbance that we call curvature of space-time is way over yonder somewhere, over by the sun, over by a star, a black hole, or something like that. But that locally, where the instrument is and the laboratory is, there's not anything going on extraordinary, and all the conservation laws are upheld there. In other words, we assume that. And for those people out there who are technical, if you please read the book by Misner, Wheeler, and Thorne, Gravitation, which is one of the best textbooks in the country in this area, you will find that they did a very good job of telling you what the assumptions in the restricted general relativity that's taught in the universities are. And so if you want to know what those assumptions are, don't take my word for it. Go check it in that book. They made a very good job of listing all of them. Now, what we are saying is, as far as it goes, that's true. But we're saying that in the scalar electromagnetics approach, what we're really doing is electrogravitation. We are turning the energy of the electromagnetic field into gravitational field locally, right there where the instrument is. And we're doing it enough to get a local curvature of space-time. Now, what we're saying is we violate the assumption that was placed on general relativity in the first place and has been upheld ever since then, just passed along and assumed. But we do not violate in any shape, form, or fashion the unrestricted general relativity. If you remove that assumption from the textbook, then the textbook already verifies you can do what John and the other inventors like John are saying they have done, and in fact, in some cases, that I have seen that they have done.
We're looking at them here tonight.
That's correct. What I'm saying is that there is a good, solid, theoretical basis for what is being done here already in physics. You don't have to take my word for it. Go into the physics book, change that assumption, and see what comes out. And when you do, you'll find out that, yes, indeed, if you have a curvature locally of space-time that is of any significance, you can extract free energy. And you do not have to conserve charge, and you do not have to conserve momentum. So I want to make one thing very clear. A law of physics, a law of nature, so to speak, is not cast in concrete. It is something that's a beautiful principle for a broad range of phenomena under very general assumptions. And almost all the time, those assumptions are upheld. But if you violate deliberately one or more of those basic assumptions that law assumes for it to be a law, then you can get around that law. And the problem in physics is when we make it dogma, not science. When we use the term a law of nature as if we had said an immutable law of God. You know, the rate of flow of time in physics used to be called immutable.
Yeah.
And before Einstein wrote relativity, it was unthinkable that the rate of flow of time itself could be changed. Now, today we know it can be changed. And yet, even though we know you can alter the flow of time, you can certainly slow it down and then speed it back up and then slow it down and speed it back up, and that is an alternation, that is a wave. We don't really want to believe that you can make time wave.
Well, you know, Tom, we're looking at devices here which defy the second law of thermodynamics.
That's correct, because if you have an unbent space-time, if you have a Lorentz frame, then you're going to obey those laws. They are based on the assumption that you don't have a local curvature of space-time. And I assure you that if you do not get such a bending of space-time locally, you will not get what we're calling free energy. The universe will demand back from you everything that it gave you.
That's right.
Now, if you bend space-time, you have a river that's flowing through the universe, just like the ordinary physical river flows by your door or by a city. It's a more subtle river, but it is a real river, and general relativity, the standard textbooks of general relativity, verify that there is such a river there in that case. It's already in the theory. It's not Tom Beard.
So the trick is to get your paddle in that river.
Well, the trick is, it's a subtle river, so it demands a new kind of paddle wheel. The conventional thinking for the way we normally build paddle wheels will not get it, because that conventional theory of how to build paddle wheels has all been based on the idea that the frame wasn't bent in the first place.
Well, I'm looking at some strange paddle wheels here tonight, right here in the studio.
That's correct. And that's exactly what John has been doing. The things that I've looked at and gone over and that have given me such great delight, he has worked out ways in which he does exactly that. And we can show conclusively that when you take electromagnetics and make it fight itself to a standstill, what we call a vector zero, it becomes stress of vacuum, stress energy of vacuum. And rigorously, in the theory, when you vary that, because you still got each of the handles that's fighting, and you can increase or decrease them, you can make waves, you have no external electromagnetic field, but you have just made an oscillating gravitational field. And it's interesting to see that the universities, and even the basic axiom in vector analysis, have ignored the real consequences of making such electromagnetic zeros. No university in the country, not a single one, has done any series of experiments with materials, and their responses to such vector zeros in electromagnetics. Not a single one. I think I'd lay out a challenge for anybody to produce a paper by a physicist in all the schools, and I'd make one single exception of Hooper. He didn't call it this, but he did this, where they actually looked at this kind of a problem. It has not been done. I've asked the heads of quite a few physics departments if they've ever seen such a series of experiments in their life, or if any of their colleagues have ever done anything like that, or any of their graduate students, and I have yet to get a yes answer to any of that. It's always been a no.
They don't want to play with it, it sounds like.
Well, what I'm urging is, it isn't that hard to do that kind of experiment. And if somebody points out to you, hey, here's a beautiful thing that vector analysis tells us we can easily do. The first thing we learn to do in vectors is add in some vectors to zero. And it doesn't seem like anybody's ever investigated what you get with electromagnetics when you do that. It seems that a true scientist who's curious about the behavior of nature and wants to work that out couldn't help but jump in there and do some experiments in that area to find out what happens.
I think it's very, it's some sort of a commentary, Tom, on the way we are right now. And here are these two young men, very bright, that work in surroundings that would be, well, you've seen them and I've seen them. It looks like a little bicycle shop somewhere. That they are producing free energy.
That's correct.
And they don't have the great gleaming laboratories and all of the things that Caltech could offer them, or UCLA or USC or TRW or McDonnell Douglas or all the great aerospace firms here, because those people will not listen. So they have to do it in their back shops under the most adverse circumstances and at great cost to them personally. But they nevertheless are doing it. And we're looking at them. And it's here. And we want to talk about this because what these men are doing back there in their little back rooms will soon free you of energy cost ever again.
Well, as you know, Bill, in my opinion, it has not been accidental. This business of pounding always on the table scientifically and mouthing off about the laws of nature as if it were dogma, and I'm not talking about, there's nothing wrong with the law of nature as long as you recognize it can be defeated.
Well, I think the law of nature is just that.
With the idea that it can never be changed under any circumstance, that is not science, that is dogma. That assumes we have perfect models, and of course we do not.
Well, it's a term we use here on the show quite often when we get on this subject, is that we look at the second law of thermodynamics. We know that that is not true anymore. The law of conservation of energy, we know that's not true anymore. But it's as if those laws were fingered by the finger of God on stone on Mount Sinai and brought down by Moses. That our scientific community deals with those laws. The fact of the matter is that those laws are not laws.
Yes, the real problem we have in science is that so many people are always trying to make it dogma and not science. For example, let me give you some specific examples.
Could you wait on those specific examples for a second?
Sure.
Because I have a specific thing I got to do here, Tom.
All right.
I'm speaking with Tom Bearden, who's on the conference line with us from Dallas, Texas tonight. In studio with me is John C. Bedini and Stephen Wirth, and also our devices that produce more energy than they use. One of the finest theoretical physicists in the world who has become enmeshed in and fascinated by the work of the two gentlemen that are in studio with me, John C. Bedini and Stephen Wirth. We're talking about free energy. I'd like for both of you men, if you don't mind, let's take a little time out because we have a dear, dear friend of Open Mind on the show, the president of the Southern California Society of Psychical Research, Dr. Elizabeth McAdams. Liz, how are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. How are you, Bill?
I'm just doing fine. What's
great
on your mind?
Well, I am having such a wonderful time, Bill, in Washington, D.C., representing the International Foundation for Survival Research at the perhaps the most historic conference, Bill, in the last 100 years for survival after death.
Mm-hmm.
We have Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island as one of the conveners of a major conference being held at Georgetown University talking about, does the consciousness survive death?
Does it?
Absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, based on the evidence. And, of course, as you and I have discussed on the show, there always needs to be more research. But Senator Pell and others, and actually astronaut Edgar Mitchell's organization, have put together this excellent conference. And I'm just very, very pleased to see that senators and congressmen are so interested in this subject.
They're beginning to find out about the intelligence of the spirit then.
Absolutely. And Senator and Mrs. Albert Gore, Jr. of Tennessee, are giving a luncheon this coming Monday for the International Foundation for Survival Research. And Senator Pell says that he's going to be able to come to Los Angeles in the next few months to receive the foundation's Distinctive Achievement Award to be given to him.
Well, we certainly want to tip our hats to all of them, Liz, for their work.
Absolutely.
You know, we've struggled long and hard to get serious attention paid to these things that a lot of people may think are rather mystic, but
absolutely,
I know of nothing more mystic than conventional religions, if you want to get down to it.
And Bill, your show, Open Mind, has done so much in all of Southern California and throughout the country to bring attention to this through the years, and so people are finally listening to it and doing something about it at the Senate level, it seems.
So now it's getting into the Senate.
Absolutely.
Well, it's gratifying to me, being a constitutionalist as I am, that the Senate is responding to the will of the people.
Absolutely.
It's about time that they listen to the people. If they would listen to them on some other things, they may solve all the problems they got out there.
Well, you know, it's very gratifying because Senator Pell of Rhode Island and Bishop John Spong of Newark and others stood up in front of 750 people this beautiful Gaston Hall was totally packed and said that, for example, Senator Pell said today that he thinks the entire human race stands a chance of making it without killing each other with a nuclear arms race if we can just be convinced once and for all from science that our consciousness survives death, despite whatever religious belief we might or might not have, that additionally, knowing of the research from science he thinks will do a great deal for the human race.
Well, you know, Senator Pell is right, Liz, that the key to our future is in science.
Yes.
And, of course, we're discussing that here right now.
You've got a wonderful show going. I was having fun listening.
And the science that these gentlemen are talking about that are with us tonight,
yes,
is the science that renders a nuclear bomb neuter.
Well, I certainly congratulate you, Bill, on another exciting show, as always.
Well, thank you.
And you take care, and if anybody would like to call the Foundation for a free booklet there in Southern California that would summarize survival after death research, all they have to do is call 213-857-5604, and your office has that, and the staff will send them a free booklet.
Right, that's the Southern California Society for Psychical Research. I'm happy to be a part of it. Liz is the president of it. You've done just monumental work, I think, in this area, giving a great deal of credence and respectability to what a lot of people might look upon as a gray area. You've made it a real area. You've now got it into the halls of Congress. Survival from a point of view that is very in league with what we're doing here in terms of science. Tom Bearden, are you still with us?
I'm still here, Bill.
All right. Let's get back to our science. Let's get back to these free energy devices, which will render the need for war useless.
Well, you know, unless, Bill, we can do something for essentially everybody that's in the world, and I'm talking about even in the darkest regions of any corner of the earth, the poorest people, in the areas where, you know, peasants live, or where very primitive tribes still exist, unless we can raise the standard of living and the conditions of living of everybody, health and so forth, we're going to continue to have an awful lot of man's inhumanity to his fellow person, or the worst case, you know, wars. We're going to have wars and wars and wars. But if we can do something that can make everybody's life a lot better, a lot easier, can take some light into those dark corners and just not have to take a whole lot of fuel and keep pumping it in there because they don't have the money to buy it, then I think we can do something for everybody. And I think cheap energy, the source is free. We'll have to pay a little bit to build the device to tap it. You have to buy a paddle wheel to go in the river.
Right.
But if we can provide cheap, clean, easily portable and easily usable energy, flexible, then I think all of that can be changed. And I think we've got to do something like that. Otherwise, we're going to have nothing but nations and groups of people set against other nations and other groups of people.
I have
and
a letter here, Tom.
We're going to use science to destroy ourselves, not to lift ourselves out of the mud.
To go with what you're talking about, I have a letter here from Prince Polani of Nigeria. And he is talking about the plight of the people of Nigeria. That those people in that country spend 70% of their wealth buying energy sources to just support the very, very primitive society that they have in Nigeria, which, of course, drains the resources of all of the people just to have electricity. Because they have no great sources of their own there, which keeps them backwards, which keeps their villages without electricity, quite often without the food that they need. They cannot develop their culture. They cannot develop the raw materials that they have within that country to develop a national thing of their own because they cannot afford the energy. And what we're looking at here in very rudimentary forms are things that they can have in each one of those little villages in Nigeria and develop their own economy, develop their own supply of goods and services, not only for themselves, but to export throughout the world. But the way they are now, and the way the most of the world is now, they are of the have-nots. And because they cannot afford the energy, they will always be the have-nots. And whenever you have a world filled with haves and have-nots, you have a world that's filled with tensions and that is on a brink of war.
Well, you also have a world filled with people who, because of poverty, lack of communication and so forth, are very easily misled, very easily gathered into large groups dominated by tyranny. And such groups then can be set against other groups, and that gives you war. If we can do something to eliminate the roots on which war feeds, then we can certainly lessen the stigma of the thing that really ravages mankind and takes the best people we have. Today, war is not a kind of a war that people used to think about, historically have thought about, that the soldiers in the field fought the war and there was very little damage to the populations, really, of the countries. And so a country could lose a war, be taken over by another country, and it really wasn't a great disaster. And that's not what we have today. What we have today is the threat of near total annihilation, certainly of great nations and maybe of most of the population of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So we find ourselves in a real quandary. On the other hand, just simply spouting off that if we would lay down our weapons, we wouldn't have war, that won't get it. Unilateral disarmament won't get it. We've got to have something that changes the fundamental problems of man all across the world. We've got to have that. I think free energy, or very cheap energy, will be one thing that does it. I'd like to add one point. We waste, in this country, we throw away our most precious resource. We discard it as if it did not even exist. And I'm talking about those rare people who have the creative genius to discover new principles of nature and new devices. I'm talking specifically about people that you can start all the way back with Nikola Tesla. You can come up to T. Henry Moore Ray. I'd include the Rogers and Rogers system. And I would include a lot of other modern-day people, and I would specifically include John Bedini, Jim Watson, Frank Golden, and Howard Johnson.
We might even throw Joe Newman in there.
And Joe Newman, certainly. He does have a machine which does work, and he deserves a patent for it. Now, what we do is we put, or try to put, these kinds of native creative geniuses in a bottle, in a box, tie a weight around their feet, and throw them in the river to drown. That's what we'd like to do. When, in fact, the spark that runs our country and makes everything better has come from the inventor. And most of those have not been the corporate inventor. They have been the lone tinkerers. They are the people who have this native genius of discovery. And that's a gift. You're born with it or you don't have it. It's not something you can teach in school. It's almost like dowsing. The individual that has that gift can sit down and start doing experiments. He will discover effects that you can sit in a laboratory in a university environment and try to do experiments for 10 years and never run across. And he'll run across them the first or second time he does it. Mm-hmm. It's just a native gift. Now, what we should do is, instead of spending vast sums of money on things like Sin Fuel corporations and so forth, we should have a system whereby the lone inventor, the creative genius, has some kind of funding set up for his experiments and his tinkering. And we should have other people who take them, things that he finds out, and go into development with it. Because development is a separate problem. And then take care of the inventor. If you did that, a lot of the things that we think are barriers would change very quickly. Well, they buried Tesla very early on for the very idea that he was going to give the world real cheap energy. And that was the last thing they wanted to do.
We can thank J.P. Morgan for that. I don't mind pointing a finger at him. History is quite adamant in its condemnation of J.P. Morgan and what he did to Nikola Tesla. He denied us free energy.
But he also gave you the Spanish-American War. He engineered that little fiasco.
I think that it wouldn't take too much to say that he gave us World War I.
A great deal of it, that's right.
And he gave us great economic disasters because of greed. And I'm looking at a young man whose life has been threatened because he wants to give you free energy right now, and that's John Bedini. And those things, of course, make me extremely angry. What we want to do, Tom, we're going to have to take a break here right now. Take a little pause for the news. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Hour 2 of Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's KABC. And we're talking about your future. And the whole new, bright, and brilliant future, if it's allowed to develop and flourish. And I think it can. And with me in the studio are two of the men that are terribly responsible for it, Mr. John C. Bedini and Mr. Stephen Wirth. And on the telephone, speaking to us from Dallas, Texas, is Thomas E. Bearden. Tom has electrified, if I can use that term, this audience for many, many years. And as we talked, John Bedini came into being. Tom, you remember that?
Yeah, I sure do. certainly do.
You know, John is amongst us. He has done some things. We're looking at things in this studio right now that would that most people that are in electronics would say are impossible, that they cannot happen. Certainly, he has just fractured the second law of thermodynamics and the law of conservation of energy with not only these two devices, but the other ones that are over there. We call it his laboratory. Well, you've seen it, and I've seen it. It's too bad he doesn't have a real laboratory to work in. But what the science is here, that we can tap this river of energy that you talk about, and it can be put to work, and it can be put to work in our homes, and it can be put to work in our industries, it can be put to work everywhere on the earth, on the world. We don't have to burn oil anymore. We don't have to build great dams anymore. We don't have to expend vast amounts of our wealth for energy. Most people don't seem to realize that their energy cost is the greatest single cost they have. Every bite of food that they eat, they pay an energy cost for. Every stitch of clothing they wear, they pay an energy cost for. Every good and service that they consume, they pay an energy cost for. And whenever you start adding all of that up on top of your electric bill and your gasoline bill, those obvious energy costs, it turns out to be a greater cost than taxes, if you can imagine that. I shouldn't say that because that'll give the IRS an idea to run forward and try to get more money than your energy costs are. Hello?
Hello. I'm still here. I was thinking about the things you were saying, and I guess one of the things that I did want to point out was that every time in science that there's been a fundamental change that occurred, there has been extreme resistance to that change. We long since have forgotten it, of course, but when Einstein brought out relativity, it was caused a furor. The conventional physicists at one time, you know, were prone to make statements like, there's only a dozen people in the world can understand it. Many physicists never accepted it to their dying day. But the young graduate students who had not yet been brainwashed didn't have that big a problem in understanding it. So when more and more of those young graduate students came out, all of a sudden relativity was an accepted term, an applied term. The thing has happened with many other things. Ironically, the fellow who really discovered conservation of energy, or mostly Meyer, was hounded literally by the scientists of his day into the insane asylum. Finally got out of there, treatment and so forth. But in his later life, he was then eulogized as a great man when he'd been called an utter fool. The great Gauss, for example, worked out nonlinear geometry and didn't dare publish it for over 30 years. He wouldn't publish it because he knew it would destroy him if he did, that his fellow scientists would destroy him.
But now they do.
Being a brash young man, published it, and they destroyed him. So science has a record. Anybody who knows anything at all about the history of science, it has a record, its own record right now, with opposing bitterly every fundamental new change that's come out.
Well, I think most everybody is familiar with the story of Madame Curie.
Certainly. The lady here recently, suddenly her name escapes me, that, you know, with the corn, with genes and so forth, that could change. That was utter nonsense. And then all of a sudden she winds up getting a Nobel Prize some decades later. But every single thing that's been a drastic change has been done that way and been opposed in that fashion. The great Planck himself, Max Planck, once said that, you know, the only way you get a new physics is when the old physicists die off that so bitterly oppose it and stop it. And I think the real thing that the experimenters like John Bedini and so forth have done is to point a very strong finger at unique effects and results that are to be gained by making deliberately electromagnetic stressed zeros. And I think the thing to do is to say, look, these kinds of effects have not been investigated by the universities. Don't you think it's about time that the universities themselves started doing the investigation? I've reached this point. If someone calls me and starts objecting to these kinds of ideas on principles in the present textbook, my first question to them is this. Have you ever done a set of experiments in this area where you made such stressed electromagnetic zeros and examined the behavior of materials and circuits and so forth with those electromagnetic entities? If the answer to that is no, I have not done such experiments and made such a great investigation, then my next response to them is, don't bother me until you have. You don't know what you're talking about. Because what happens is that people like John Bedini are doing that. And a whole host of other young fellows right now who are beginning to do these kinds of experiments. And the thing we really are trying to do, and John is trying to do, is to try to point out to these young fellows, don't believe these self-imposed limitations and assumptions. You can change those assumptions. And in this area, if your textbook doesn't tell you what happens when you make this kind of thing, go do your own experiments and find out. Do it by the scientific method. Don't believe dogma.
These laws were not fingered by God on tablets of stone on Mount Sinai.
That's correct. If as long as you do not change the assumptions on which those laws are based, you're going to get those laws. They are very good laws, very good descriptions. So if you change some of the fundamental assumptions, and here we're changing one of them, because all of those conservation laws assume you do not have stress zeros like that, where energy is locked into vacuum and deliberately varied by patterns, deterministic patterns. If you have not investigated those kinds of experiments, you have nothing scientifically to reject it out of hand with. So at least reserve the judgment until you've done experiments. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the new energy developments that John and Steve have done.
Well, I appreciate your comments there, Tom. I just wanted to add one thing. A friend of yours and mine was a guest on this, Dr. Ruggiero Santelli. And he pointed out a very, very important fact, I think, concerning the universities when they get into this kind of experimentation. And certainly we have great citadels of learning here in Southern California, and a lot of those people listen to this radio program. And we have great aerospace industries that are deeply involved in science. But if they were to start getting into these experiments, they have all at once rendered their textbooks useless. They have kissed off great grants, goodbye, and contracts, goodbye, based upon an old science. And they do not want to upset the economic apple cart or their egomaniac apple cart, because they are now the great gurus of science. We do have that problem of ego to deal with, don't we?
Yes, we do, and I can't resist giving one quote. This quote is from the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology, you know, standard whole shelf of reference books all in one great encyclopedia. Very well done set of books, by the way. When you add all this stuff up we're talking about in physics, in the ordinary physics, you get invariance that's behind all the conservation laws, or they go hand in hand together. If you do what we're talking about, you break the idea of invariance. If you oscillate space-time, the curvature of space-time, you do not have to have invariance from one time or one place to another. And let me give you the quote. Without such invariance, laws of nature would change with the passage of time. They were talking about the time invariance. And repeating an experiment would have no clear-cut meaning. In fact, science, as it is known today, would not exist. So what we're saying is, the restrictions that are placed on the science today, the conservation laws and invariance, can be changed. That's what we're stating. We're stating how you can change it, in principle, in detail. And we are pleading with the university graduate students, and with the professors too, if they would like to, please do some experiments in this area and see for yourself. Use the scientific method, but if you've not done any experiments, it is not scientific to immediately reject it out of hand. At least give it a chance.
Which they've not wanted to do so far.
Very few. A few have, and a few have gotten results. I might mention, of course, Professor Ramon Sanchez, who gave it a try, and he got some excellent results. He's another one of those brilliant people I was talking about, creative.
He found out how to extract energy from a distance.
That's right. He actually did the cross beams experiment, and it did work. There are others. I don't mean to say that I've, by any means named all the people. I've just named a few that I've personally worked with. And those people, and many others like them throughout the country, that are doing these unorthodox experiments, and particularly the ones that are doing what we've very strongly pointed out here, what John and I have pointed out, are getting results. Now, the problem we all have is that we're still back, figuratively speaking, in this new stuff, we're back very similar stages to where they were in electromagnetics when they were still rubbing glass rods with Kepler trying to work out electromagnetism. The only way we're ever going to get this new science born is for all the sharp young graduate students and all these universities to start doing these kinds of experiments. There's 100 Nobel Prizes out there waiting for you, but it's not waiting for you by simply applying the other stuff that's already been worked out. Go find something new, and here's a whole new area. Have a go at it.
You won't find a Nobel Prize for yourself in your textbooks.
That's correct.
And I'm looking at two men who have put the textbooks aside because they have gone further beyond that. Are you ready to talk to the folks? Tom?
Oh, yes.
All right. Let me give the telephone numbers. If you have questions about free energy or a new kind of energy that you don't have to pay for, let's put it that way, we'll come Bedini and Steve Wirth in Dallas, Texas, on our conference line is Tom Bearden. Also in studio with me are some little devices that certainly do not operate in conjunction with the second law of thermodynamics or the law of conservation of energy. They're just destroying those two highly respected principles. But so be it.
But what we have to remember, Bill,
is that's how nature works. Nature works this way. Nature doesn't have to pay any attention to any laws at all.
Yeah, it doesn't really care about the laws that man
may
come up with.
Man, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't have any new laws.
Actually, you know, we touched upon a term a little bit ago, gravity engineering.
It's exactly,
gravitational engineering.
That's right, Bill. That's exactly what this is. It's gravitational engineering, and this world better get ready for it.
So you're engineering gravity to do work for you.
That's right. If our planet spins day in and day out, then there's no reason why we can't tap the spin of the planet, generate all the energy we want, and live like people are supposed to live. We won't have to look at gray skies anymore.
You have a device that turns counterclockwise here in the northern hemisphere and just produces energy like it was going out of style. Right. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you have to turn to the other.
I would imagine it would want to go counterclockwise.
Yeah. And so you're engineering gravity. You're creating electricity for it. Okay, let's go to our callers and see what's on their mind. Who's our first one here, Terry? All right, Craig, you're on.
Am I really? All right.
You're on.
You're actually coming in good and clear tonight.
Craig, you're up at where? Malpitas or up there someplace?
No, in Mid-Pines.
Okay.
Anyways.
Glad to have you aboard, and I know it's a strain for you to try to get us up there, but we're glad to have you.
Well, the reception's good tonight. Let's see. Okay, I'll kind of reverse the order of my questions.
We have our energy devices working on the transmitter here.
Maybe. John, you were just about to describe the operation of your pendulum device. I am really totally unclear from the previous description as to how it taps into the energy field. Can you elaborate on that, Tim?
Yes, I can. I have been making chart recordings. You're familiar with that, right?
Specifically, what do you mean?
Chart recordings, like you would chart record earthquakes.
Oh, sure.
Okay. I have been noting that at certain times of the night that the pendulum picks up in momentum. And by that pendulum picking up in momentum, I'm gaining energy without putting any energy into the system.
Okay.
Now, I am describing to you a pendulum, which is a monopole motor in the center.
Before you go further, when you say monopole motor...
One pole, Craig. One pole, a north pole.
That's one thing that didn't make sense.
No complete circuit path, Craig. If you're going to gain any energy, you cannot have a complete circuit path.
Where would a regular old person come across a monopole magnet?
Craig?
Yes.
It's the way you place the magnet in the circuit.
Is it a conventional magnet?
One pole of a magnet. Yes, it is. It's a samarium cobalt magnet.
Okay.
I am only using one pole of the magnet. The North Pole.
So it is a dipole magnet, but it's being used...
as a monopole.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Now, I am describing to you, Craig, a monopole motor running a conventional generator. The conventional generator makes up the same magnetic circuits that you are familiar with in the textbook. So... what we have here is a monopole motor driving a pendulum effect. Certain times of the night, it will pick up because of the Earth's rotation, because it's not what is known as a planetarium pendulum that changes the arc as the Earth spins. You follow me?
Yes.
So what we want to do is pick up the momentum in the middle of the night. We are talking about an item which generates pulse currents. We're not necessarily looking for a constant output, Craig. We're looking for something that goes past the generator poles, produces amperes in a pulse. And that we are sending back to the battery by driving the monopole motor with very little input.
Now, where is the monopole motor in relation to the pendulum?
Right in the center. As the North Pole passes the trigger circuitry that's on this monopole motor, it produces a push, which keeps this pendulum rocking no matter what. And then, through conventional means, which is in the textbook, we want to gather the energy by the swing of the pendulum. Now, it is also possible to put a sprag gear or pump water all day long with this pendulum the same way that an oil well pumps.
You're just extracting the energy in electrical form.
That's right. I am not wasting one bit of energy. I'm returning it back to the system.
So what is essentially the difference you're saying is in the design of the pendulum itself?
Craig, I want you to get... in fact, I want everybody to get a piece of paper and a pencil out there. And I want you to draw a normal pendulum. And underneath that pendulum, right in the center, I want you to put a magnetic coil of some type. And we'll call that the motor. On the opposite ends of the motor, right and left as you face the pendulum, I want you to put two generation coils. I want the monopole to go back and forth between center, right, and left. And as it goes between center, right, and left, it generates a pulse in current output. I want you to return that back to the battery. So you can see that the motor's off as it generates. You're only using that motor for a little bitty push. It's the same as an oscillatory action in a Tesla coil. He was very specific when he said, vibrate the thing. Make it oscillate. The faster you make it oscillate, the more energy you will get. Is that clear?
Clear enough as far as you've gone. What I don't understand then is you were saying if you were to use it in a different application, where would the monopole motor fit in?
Craig? I want you to block out everything in your mind that you've ever been taught.
Okay.
All right? I want you to put the books down. I want you to forget about what you've been taught. What I want to do is open your mind up to think about how we can engineer a gravitational system to do the work for us. And we're going to do that with one of the simplest things, and that's a pendulum. Now, it's like a 500-pound weight on a swing, Craig. And behind that's a little child, and he's giving it a little tap. Sooner or later, it's going to go over the top, isn't it?
Perhaps.
Try it in the park sometime. That's all this motor is used for, is to give it a little tap every once in a while when the pendulum thinks that it's going to run down. Now, figure out in your mind a triggering circuit using a monopole, or one pole of one magnet. Now, how would you do that, Craig?
Why don't you just go on? I'm not sure where you're trying to take it.
Craig, I am trying to get you to put down the book for a moment. I want everybody to put down the book. It's not in the books. I want you to open your mind and really think for a moment. Your wildest imagination. I'm going to take you on a ride right now. I'm going to put you on the swing set, Craig, and I'm going to get a little three-year-old to give you a tap every once in a while you're swinging away. Sooner or later, that little three-year-old is going to get you at 90-degree angle, and you're going to fall off the swing, aren't you?
Well, if that's the crux of your argument, I don't know if I agree with that.
What, Craig? I'm trying to...
We're looking at it, Craig. It's sitting here working.
Craig, okay. I am trying to get you to use the part of your mind that you've never used before.
Well, tell me something. Tell me where I'm going wrong here. Using your analogy of a three-year-old pushing somebody to swing, as the person goes up, the gravity vector increases, okay, and it's very difficult to get someone up to the 90-degree angle.
Well,
it's increasingly difficult to get someone further up.
Craig, right. If it was at the right time and the swing was oriented exactly right, the Earth would help you. It would add a little bit of energy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if you could set it up right.
Okay. I am using orthodox laws right now. The pendulum shows us the rotation of the Earth, right? So why not use the rotation of the Earth to aid us in getting energy?
Okay, so how are you setting up the pendulum differently to take advantage of that?
A normal pendulum, Craig. A normal pendulum, except that I have aided that pendulum by what I call a monopole motor, which gives that magnetic pole a little push every time the pendulum passes it. Now, I am taking advantage as that monopole crosses the two inductance coils on either side as a generator. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
I want you to send that back to the battery in a pulse.
Right. That's where you're pulling the energy out, sure.
That's right. So for 1.4 watts input, I could wind any coil I wanted for the output, never losing any energy, Craig. You see, I'm going to take advantage of what this big planet that we sit on does for us. And it spins. So why not use it?
It's a big dynamo, isn't it?
That's right. It's just waiting. And what really gets me hot under the collar, Bill, is what our science has taught us. They haven't shown us anything in 100 years. They have absolutely suppressed everything that could aid the people. Now, we could pump hundreds of gallons of water, Craig, for that little 1.4 watts and take advantage of the Earth, at the same time recharging the batteries that are running this pendulum. Now, if somebody makes a great big huge one, a typical example of that pendulum is in Joe Newman's motor. Okay, how does it keep the dry cell batteries charged? Very simply, Craig, a spike. You know what a spike is?
Sure.
The spike is very important in gravitational engineering. And it only finds itself releasing its energy if the item that it's going back to is nonlinear. Do you follow that? What happens, Craig, what happens in a computer if I take an electrostatic gun and walk up to the computer? Doesn't it blow out?
Okay.
Fine.
Yes.
But that tells you something. That tells you, if you really observe that, that that little spike is very potent in a non-linear arrangement.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
And to take advantage of that spike, you have to have a non-linear arrangement. That is why I want you to get your paper and pencil out. I want you to listen to what I'm saying. And I want you to use your imagination for it. Never mind what you've been taught. That may not be correct someday. I want you to use your mind in engineering gravitational equipment that we can use.
And with that, Craig, we're going to have to go to some of the other callers. Unless you have one last question, do you want to pop
the door? Yeah, I want to ask Tom Bearden something. He had mentioned that there are people who are doing experiments with scalar energy. He named one. That was one point where I couldn't hear clearly. I don't know if there's any others he could name. I wonder if he would be kind enough to name them and say where they're working and if they've had any papers that have actually been published.
I just named some of the people, Craig, that I've worked with myself personally. I didn't, intend to say that I was naming everybody by any means. I named, of course, John Bedini, and everybody has a pretty good idea of the various devices and free energy devices he's built. He's built also a pretty doggone good scalar detector. And by the way, scalar electromagnetics is electrogravitation. I named Frank Golden. I worked with him for quite a few years. Frank has done some rather fundamental things. Only recently, scalar waves will go through water, will go through the earth. He has built some scalar communication systems. He's built a whole series, a rather large number of different kinds of scalar antennas and scalar detectors. He's worked out a beautiful series of very sophisticated detection instruments that allows him to detect scalar waves from storms, scalar waves that are placed onto weather and so forth by the Soviet Union. Measure the scalar taps that the Soviet Union has placed into the Earth itself and put the Earth in scalar resonance. And he has, in fact, mapped the entire scalar resonance frequency responses of the Earth up to quite a large number.
Where does he work?
He works independently. He's an independent inventor. All by himself. He's also done some extremely fundamental work in the field of boosting up the power of radionics. We had the privilege of being present when John Bedini took his scalar wave detector and measured that instrument and proved conclusively it does put out scalar waves. He's done a large number of things like that. Ramon Sanchez, I named Professor Sanchez, has done a lot of experiments in with a scalar in the microwave frequency, like 5 gigahertz and so forth, with the beams and crossing the beams and extracting energy and the little cold explosion over water and so forth. And, of course, I named John Bedini.
Yeah.
I didn't give a complete list of names, but those are the main ones that I had named. I named Howard Johnson. Howard, as you know, has a patent on a permanent magnet motor, and Howard personally demonstrated to me that he had a rotary device, and he personally demonstrated to me that he can make a North Pole, attract the North Pole, and I'm telling you, anybody can do that can make a motor.
Where's Professor Sanchez based?
He's in Los Angeles.
And he said he's done a lot of mapping of scalar potentials.
That was Frank Golden.
Okay. Well, have either of them published the results anymore?
No. They don't intend to.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, you get yourself threatened if you do. For another thing, if you publish real definitive results and you're trying to be an inventor, what you wind up doing is giving away your invention. And so many of them are trying to bring certain things to the patent area so that they can market them and then go ahead from there.
So publishing, see, Craig, is not the reason for invention. The reason for invention is to move it into the marketplace.
Well, sure.
Now, I would name some other folks. I would certainly, I have the greatest admiration for Professor William Tiller, who's built a very fundamental detector, in my opinion. I have and done some enormous work in all kinds of areas that are on the far-flung frontiers of science. I have a great admiration for Dr. Robert Beck, who has personally demonstrated at some personal expense and some hazard to himself, scalar communication systems, the scalar transmitters and receivers that go through Faraday cages, and he's done a lot of work in ELF and so forth long before it was fashionable to know the effects of those kinds of devices, and so I'd certainly include him in the area. I would include people like Bill Bice and Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, Pete Kelly in radionics. Certainly I would include Dr. Hieronymus, the founder of the modern phase of amplified radionics. I would include him as a very great inventor and pioneer in this area.
So there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people out there, Craig.
And, I know that.
And they are very impressive people, and their work is very, very impressive.
The problem that they have, Craig, is that because it's unorthodox work, there are no provisions for funding in this area. There are also no provisions for a lot of the things we take for granted in science. For example, if I want to do research in ordinary science, I can go down to the library, and I've got the resources of the world at my fingertips. If I can't find a book or a paper anywhere else, I can get it directly out of the Library of Congress long enough to get a copy. But in this area, there's not even anybody doing card cataloging or cataloging the material or digesting the material or giving you an abstract or a review of what it means or anything like that. But we don't have the resources or anything to do that. We don't have really good journals in this area at all because nobody has the monetary resources to do that.
Right.
We could certainly get along a lot faster and a lot quicker if we did have some resources to set up the standard things you'd like to do to be able to share all the information with everybody else starting anew.
Right. Well,
one of the things we can tell you we are doing, this show will be made available in cassette form. We'll tell you more about that. But you're getting a lot of information here tonight from John and from Tom, and that will be made available to you very quickly.
The reason I asked about publishing is, since you're asking people to do research at universities, I would think it would be very helpful to those people, or motivate those people, to give them something to work with, to start with.
Bill?
If there was published information.
Craig?
Yeah.
We will make available a tape on the pendulum generator.
Mm-hmm.
I think you ought to say that louder, John. I don't think that came over too clear.
We,
excuse me. I had my mic off.
Yeah, turn it back on.
The little thing. We will make available a tape on the pendulum generator, Craig, with laboratory measurements, orthodox rules.
So that you can see it all.
So that you can make it yourself.
And with that, we're going to have to run, Craig.
Right.
And I appreciate your questions. They're always very thought-provoking, and that's the reason I give you a little extra time.
Okay, I appreciate everything you're doing up there.
All right. Down, yeah, you're way up in Northern California tonight. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Tom Dave. Hi, Dave. Welcome aboard.
Hello, Tom. How are you tonight?
Fine. How's it going, Dave?
Very good. Now, I think I want to ask Mr. Bedini the first question. On the return from the battery to the motor, what is that direct from the battery back to the motor, or how is it wired?
I will explain this to you.
I'm just interested in the return to make the pulse.
The return path is nothing more than a pulse.
What's the electrical connection?
The electrical connection is as the monopole portion of the magnet goes past the generating coils.
Right.
The motor turns itself off.
Yeah.
After the push.
All right.
You then supply the pulse energy back to the battery through a rectifier. So what you're looking for is a current with high potential.
Uh-huh.
You want a high voltage spike back to that battery. This then is...
That comes out of the induction coil, the pickup coil, right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly how this system works.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I will tell you that I disconnected them tonight to bring them to KABC.
Yeah.
But the pendulum has been running for about 14 to 15 days,
yeah,
constantly, If you want to measure the battery right at this moment, I will guarantee you that it's at 13 volts.
13-volt battery.
Well, it's your standard lead-acid cells that make up a 12-volt battery.
All right, what's the output of the motor then?
1.2 watts.
For the voltage?
12 volts.
All right.
And it will run down as low as 5 1/4 volts.
Yeah.
We'll push the pendulum.
Uh-huh.
But I don't worry about what's going in. I worry about what's coming out and being returned to the battery.
That's right.
You see, if you can engineer a motor that never draws any more current, you've just beaten all the theory.
Yeah, but you're using a cobalt magnet, too.
Well, I could use a regular barium ferrite magnet. I can still engineer the same system given any set of tools.
What about using something like a plutonium magnet?
I don't know of one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe neodymium iron. That's the newest one that I know of. I've never heard of a plutonium magnet.
It would be expensive, I know
that.
Yeah. All right, now, I think that answered that question. Now, I think Mr. Bearden, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dave.
All right. Now, you were talking about the vacuum of the gravity, right?
0 point of gravity, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking about the gravitational field in the sense, in the pure general relativistic sense, where what we mean by gravitational field is curvature of space-time.
All right, well, now, doesn't the gravity rely on the vector of the mass, the frequency of the mass to create a vacuum?
How about restating that? You went by me.
Well, I was going to say on the gravity, don't we rely on the vector of the frequency of the mass to create the vacuum?
No. The vacuum is considered to be a separate state.
Well, the vacuum has to be created by the mass.
No. It's the other way around. In general relativity, the only thing that mass really is, fundamentally, is a kink or a curvature in space-time, and you can identify space-time with vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to say the mass creates a vacuum in the time-space frequency related to the mass itself.
No, the mass does not create the vacuum. As a matter of fact, the best theories of the universe allow the vacuum to assume excited states all by itself and pump itself up and then to explode, so to speak, as it decays back down to the ground state. And that's what is about the best theory we've had right now on how the whole thing with the mass and everything in it got going.
Well, now, wouldn't you have to have the frequency of the vacuum?
No, the vacuum has every frequency in it you can name.
Yeah, but the frequency of the mass that's created within the vacuum itself.
Are you talking about the virtual mass?
Yes.
The virtual particles?
Yes.
Well, there are virtual photons, virtual particles, and virtual everything else.
Each one has its own frequency.
Hey, gentlemen, I have a virtual frequency that I've got to do right now. if you don't mind, I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Mark Markham, we'll take a break. Dave, I want you to wrap up your questions to Tom real fast because we're running short of time.
Let me finish the answer to that last question. I didn't finish it. Dave, I think what you're asking is correct in this fashion. Scalar-wise, I regard the mass per se, any kind of mass, as a standing scalar wave, a standing wave in vacuum. It's locked in, trapped by the spin of a particle, for example.
That's true, but it still has to have the physical mass.
That's correct. The mass itself is the standing wave. The inertia and all that's due to that. Now, in the sense that you give a structure to that mass, for example, if it's a proton, and I consider it to be made of partons and so forth,
yeah,
then it's a complex of trapped scalar resonances.
That's right, but now, you have to figure the vector of the mass to arrive at the frequency.
30 seconds, guys.
No, it's the other way around. We figure the mass from the fact of the amplitude of that complex or that single standing wave. And in fact, we can decrease the mass and inertia, or we can increase it by increasing the scalar resonance.
That's absolutely right.
All right, listen, guys, I know, Dave, we haven't quite got your question answered here.
Well,
we're going to take a little break. If you want to hang on the phone, it's perfectly all right with me, okay?
All right, I'll stick around.
All right, stick around.
All right.
Radionics devices, bioenergetics devices, the things that are going to change your world and mine. And let's continue on with, I believe, Dave, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, Dave, let's finish this matter about mass and vacuum that you and Tom were talking about.
You there, Tom?
Yes.
All right, now, maybe I was a little bit wrong in what I said. What I was trying to get over is that the mass in molecular physics requires a frequency and the vector to create the vacuum. Now, without the vacuum, the molecular physics wouldn't hold true. Due to the fact that the molecular structure would disintegrate.
Well, that's certainly true that without the vacuum, you wouldn't have a physical universe at all because everything's made of vacuum, matter, everything else.
That's what I'm trying to explain.
Exactly right.
Right. All right. Now, one thing I don't understand, how to do away with the vacuum.
You can't do away with it. The vacuum is at a very high stress level.
Yes, I know it is.
And what you can do is change or pattern that stress. You can make the direction in which you oscillate waves of stress up and down, just like a sound wave in the ocean or something.
That's right.
And you can make directional patterns and so forth. But you see, given the ability to do that, we've done what is called polarizing the vacuum. And if you can do that, you can do some rather magnificent things.
Yeah, but if we could break down the molecular structure, the vacuum ceased to exist.
So far as I know, I don't... You know, with what we're talking about, the electromagnetics, we certainly don't have the power to do that. The kinds of things they're talking about when they say the vacuum reached this super excited state and then decayed, exploded, and so forth to create the universe as we know it. And that kind of a theory, the kinds of energies and the kinds of things they're talking about are so far beyond the kinds of energies we're using that, you know, we're not in that ball game at all. So I really don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, well, I was working on that type of a theory and trying to work out. I misplaced a lot of my papers, and I don't know where they are. I haven't found them.
Uh-huh.
But I'd worked this idea out into a feasible equation, and I misplaced my papers, and I can't remember the exact theory now.
Well, there you are.
Okay.
All I can say is more and more of the vacuum in modern physics is assuming ever more importance every day. That's certainly true.
That's very true.
All right, does that help you, Dave?
Yeah, it does a lot, Tom, and Bill, and I thank you very much, and I thank you, Tom, and I thank you, John.
Well,
thank you, Dave, for tuning in.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Glad to have you aboard.
Okay.
We're getting some good questions here tonight, guys, and let's see what Edson has on his mind.
Good evening, everybody.
How are you?
How are you? First, a couple of comments about Tesla. As you know, I'm always writing about Tesla. First, that the late Orson Welles' last movie was The Secret, Nikola Tesla, but that's hardly mentioned in the tributes to that great personality.
The movie did not get seen by too many people.
No, and it's kind of hard to even find a copy that's still in America.
It did not say good things about J.P. Morgan in Wall Street.
No, not at all.
I've watched the movie 100 times.
Well, maybe they'll bring it back and show it in some art theater in L.A. I hope they do. Also, if any of your listeners know anything about the Tesla Pierce Arrow car that's supposed to operate on free energy.
It's here in Southern California somewhere, but we can't find it.
Yeah, well, perhaps somebody can contact you, and then we can get in touch with you, because Nick Basura, as you know, he's a great Tesla fan, and I are trying to track down what happened to this Pierce Arrow. Still around someplace. Now, I worked for several years with the late Dr. Albert Roy Davis, and he wrote a book, Magnetism and Its Effects on the Living System. And one of the chapters in this book has to do with the gravitational effect, that is, magnetic effect on weight, gravitational weight. And I wonder if this has to do with your generator, if it loses some weight in the magnetic field.
Yes, it does.
Uh-huh. Could you give the Gauss strength of the magnets that you
it's
use?
It's samarium cobalt, and I'm not quite sure on the Gauss of this magnet, but I will tell you the physical size.
Mm-hmm.
It's a half inch in diameter by a little bit less than a quarter inch.
That's
running these machines.
I see. Is there a moon tidal effect on your generator?
Yes, there is. And I was going to mention that, and that's a very good question, because when the full moon comes out, the pendulum does pick up the same way as the ocean bulges.
Well, we got that this evening. How about the figure eight effect of the electrons? Lissajou, electronic display, is that involved with the generator?
You can do it that way, and you will find out that it's not quite a figure eight.
Mm-hmm. What if you took, I understand this is operating, is it counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere?
It seems that all the energy machines want to run, yes, counterclockwise in this hemisphere.
What if you took this to the magnetic equator of the Earth? Would there be a loss of power?
I haven't been able to do that kind of testing because I'm very limited right at this moment.
Uh-huh.
We suspect it would run in either direction on the true equator. In January, I'm going to go down to Fiji. We'll stop on the equator.
But we can engineer the systems to run either direction in this hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question for Colonel Bearden. I talked to Dr. Jastrow last night on Ray Bream's show, and it was about Star Wars, particle beams, and so on. Now, Dr. Jastrow says that the Russians are planning to use MHD, magnetohydrodynamic generators, to power these particle beam weapons that actually Tesla invented way back in the 30s. And I remember that Colonel Bearden said something about the use of this death ray of Tesla in Afghanistan. Perhaps you could comment on that again. And could you, gentlemen, give us an address to write to Bedini Electronics, is it, and Colonel Bearden?
I'll give you the address right now. Have you got a pencil and paper?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you want information on this particular generator or any of the books that pertain to this, there's two places to get them. One is the Tesla Book Company at 1580 Magnolia Boulevard in Melbrae, California.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the zip right offhand. And the other
94030.
94030.
Okay.
And the other is Bedini Electronics, P.O. Box 769, San Fernando, California, 913341.
341. Okay.
I always get the two numbers mixed up between Silmar and San Fernando.
Yeah. So, does Colonel Bearden know about the death ray, any more about the death ray being used?
Let me give you an address since you wanted that too.
Mm-hmm.
My address is Post Office Box 1472, Huntsville, Alabama, 35807. As far as the death ray that they're using, if you have a very powerful scalar beam and you hit the human nervous system with it, the nervous system is highly nonlinear. It's not built at all like a bunch of wires carrying ordinary currents. You have something very much resembling a spark detector almost.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens if you hit the scalar nervous system, the scalar part of the nervous system with a strong scalar beam, you simply cut off the entire nervous system, and that's instantaneous death. Now, in Afghanistan, a very strange thing has been noted, and it's the fact that this occurs, not the fact that it's scalar at all, but the fact that this occurs has been documented in places like Jane's Defense Weekly. When the high-end helicopters, for example, come in, they've been using gas against the Afghans and testing things like mustard gas and nerve gas and so forth, and of course, the gas kills people. And nerve gas kills them very quickly. But even with nerve gas, a biological system, it takes a short time to die. And during that time, the system convulses. Now, if you've ever seen an animal or anything killed with nerve gas, it's terrible convulsions for at least a few seconds, like half a minute or so. And a human does the same thing. But there is a... So the Hind will come in and it will fire rockets, you know, and deliver the gas and so forth, and people will die with mustard gas or they will die with nerve gas symptoms. But then there's another kind, and they're referring to it in Afghanistan as smirch.
Hmm.
This kind, the body dies instantly right where it's at. It never makes another move, and apparently the nervous system never fires another signal anywhere. It collapses like a limp rag right there. That's it. Total instantaneous death. No chemical that I know of will do that. The other thing is, at least one occasion that is documented, an entire village was wiped out this way after the fighting guerrillas, the Mujahideen, had left. And they were able to come back to the village about 30 days later. And the bodies of all the villagers who had been killed this way had not decayed at all. No decay whatsoever in 30 days. The reason for that, apparently, was the normal things that happen when a body dies, like turning loose of enzymes and all kinds of things, because normally a body dies by degrees. And the other things that the bacteria and all that are in the body, apparently all the bacteria were killed, and the body died instantly, didn't turn loose any of the enzymes or anything, and so no decay occurred. So apparently the Soviet Union has been using, very slyly, and doing a little testing with tactical scalar beams in an air personnel role in Afghanistan from behind the helicopter. That's my opinion, at least.
There's a great deal of data to support that opinion.
I may have some information on that, Tom.
Okay.
I have been doing experiments with a high-voltage Tesla coil, and I'll tell you what I've been doing. I have been purifying water by capturing the ozone, which kills all the bacteria. Now, maybe what may be happening is you're getting little electrical sparks inside the body cells, and the ozone from that little electrical spark is curing or killing the bacteria that would normally start to occur in that process.
That may be the explanation.
Okay, now I only know that because of the experiments that I've been doing on bacteria to find a way to clean up all our water for L.A.
Right.
Which needs all the help it can get.
We need a lot of help and a lot of water all over the country.
And I'll tell you, the easiest solution for that is the Tesla coil.
But it's not chemicals, and so therefore the aircraft will not fire.
Right. It doesn't have anything to do with chemicals, and there's a very unique way to do that, and that's produce the high voltage and suck the ozone from that high voltage and bubble it through the water. And within 5 minutes, the chlorine and everything and all the bacteria is dead in that water, and you have pure water.
Well, you know, we need to do something, because the primary way we purify water with the chlorine is diabolical. The intake of chlorine into the body when we drink water is not good for you at all. It's been at least implicated in heart disease. And it's even to the point now where they're warning you about taking showers, because when you beat the water on something like you do when you're taking a shower, well, you free more chlorine and you breathe it in. You get it direct in the lungs, you get it direct in your bloodstream. So it's sort of between a rock and a hard place. We use the chlorine so that the water doesn't make us sick, and yet over a long period of years, the chlorine can contribute to disease and decay.
Well, we don't allow any in our house. The chlorine is all gone.
It's a pretty bad situation, though, Bill, when you start to get, you know, a system like that supplies L.A., and you can't even put fish in the water because they just die and float upside down.
And we're supposed to drink that.
Well, and all the people that have had problems because of the ammonia. But one solution is that ozone generators, not that it's good for you to breathe it yourself internally, but it can clear up the water. I mean, you could just put a little ozone in the reservoir and never worry about bacteria again. It just refuses to live.
All right, Edson, you see what you triggered here?
Yeah, great. There's going to be a cassette tape of this show, understand?
Yes, there will be this show, the Weather War show we did with Tom Bearden some time back, the one with Dr. Marcel Vogel, the one with Dr. Berg about the Kabbalah, and the one in 2 weeks with Robert Monroe and the out-of-body experience, when we'll have the out-of-body travelers from Virginia come right into our studio, investigate, go back to Virginia, and check back with us.
Oh, that's great.
So those will all be available to you.
Really great show.
All right.
Thank you.
Hey, Bill, while I can interject a point here, since you mentioned that Weather War tape, I wanted to mention that we found evidence that the thing I've been calling the giant radio from the ground, where you see a large thing, has actually been photographed from satellites and is being called in the literature the enhanced V. I'm talking about the letter V.
Uh-huh.
And it has been photographed from satellites, and I'll give a real quick reference since this will be on the tape, and you can pursue it from there. National Weather Digest, Volume 10, Number 2, May 1985. Along about page 7, there's an article that will give you references to the enhanced V
and will show you some pictures taken by satellite of that effect.
By the way, two observers here in Southern California saw the radials the other night. Mr. Bedini, Mr. Jenkins.
Well, good.
It was too dark to get videotape of those, although we do have the other videotapes.
We're watching for you, Tom.
Good.
We're also taking tuner measurements of what's going on.
Well, I just wanted to bring out the fact that the thing has been spotted from the satellites, and it has been definitely associated with severe weather.
And the Weather Wars show is fascinating, and I might point out that the article in Let's Talk magazine, which will be out in the next week or so, is based upon Tom's material, and we'll have some photographs in there for you in the magazine and some graphics and go over some of the data that we have covered before. So I hope everybody will be getting a copy of Let's Talk. All right, Edson, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back with John Bedini to define a scalar wave, if you would.
Okay. I'll do it two ways. First of all, imagine you have a steel plate, that's your medium, and you have a set of forces on both sides pushing in so that they balance and sum to zero. Okay, leave the set of forces on there. That plate is under stress. That's a quite different plate from a plate that has no forces at all acting on it, even though the resultant of those forces is zero. Now imagine that the forces are being produced by, say, two hands, a bunch of fingers. You increase the force with which you're pushing, but they still sum to zero. And you do it all at the same time, and you regularly increase and decrease the force with which you're pushing, but they always sum to zero. In that plate, you have a rhythmic stress wave, but never did the plate have a resultant force acting on it to push it in one direction or the other. It's a squeeze and relax wave. Okay, that's a scalar wave. If you do this now in vacuum, where you have electric fields and or magnetic fields opposing themselves or adding together to make a zero, and you increase and decrease the magnitude of all of those forces, but they always remain sum to zero. The energy of each one of those waves is locked in there in that system that sums to a zero vector. And so as you increase the forces, everything is dynamic at base, you're increasing the energy and decreasing the energy density of vacuum. And by definition, by pure general relativity, that is a gravitational wave. What you have done is you have taken electromagnetic field energy, force field energy, and turned it into gravitational potential field energy. And that is a scalar wave. A scalar and magnetic fields of a bunch of components sum to zero, but they're still in that zero, still there and still acting, and rhythmically varying. And you are creating a stress wave in space-time, and that's a gravitational wave.
That should answer the question that was put forth. Now let's go on to Tom, who's on the line. Hello, Tom.
Oh, hello. Who's this?
This is Bill.
This is Tom. I'd like to address Mr. Tom Baden.
Okay.
Pertaining to a Japanese invention, Inco Company, I believe, invented this so-called motor. It's similar, I think, to the one Tom described previously. May I describe it?
Yes.
It's a starter, and in this starter is ferrite magnetic poles, ferrite magnets.
Right.
Now, on top of one of these poles is a timed electro pulse DC. Now, that's on the starter. I'm just a simple electrician, so anyway.
You're doing good. Go ahead.
Now,
you're absolutely correct.
There's a single pole rotor. This being pulsed, it sends the single pole rotor, say in a clockwise rotation, it's repelled by the electromagnet, and the rotor is sent on its way, and say it's going clockwise, it's helped by these ferrite magnets to make a complete revolution, and then it's pulsed again and throws it again. Now, This is, has to be first, has to be started by something on the externally started, and then this keeps on going. Now, the purpose of this is to conserve battery juice by this pulsing, and with the help of the ferrite magnets, you gain energy, and you save battery juice. And it's a battery motor, really, with very low consumption. Now, Ilko invented it, and I was wondering if Mr. Bearden heard of it, or any of you gentlemen heard of it.
I've not heard of it. Maybe John has.
Yes, I know.
Oh, thank God.
You have described a process which you yourself know, which could free yourself completely from oil.
From oil?
That's right. What? If you utilize the poles in the
floor. Oh, I see what you mean, yes. Sir.
Right, you already know
what
the true thing is.
Yeah.
So make it.
And we happen to have one that's almost exactly what you
described. Almost identical. Now change the situation into monopoles.
Yeah.
You see, you don't need a north and a south in a motor.
That's right.
That's put there for somebody's convenience to waste energy.
Oh, I see.
All right.
The critical thing is if you have a motor of any kind of design and the battery runs down, you know, you don't have at that point what we're talking about. If the battery stays up there and charged up and the thing keeps running, and you can get a little bit of energy out of it, any amount at all that you can throw out of the system, burn up and use up, and you're free to use, then you have the kind of thing we're talking about.
Oh, I see.
Which is, by the way, Tom, is very easily done with what he's describing.
Yeah, and I think that if I understood John right, what John is saying, I cut in on this program just a little bit after it started, so I missed part of that. But if I understand him right, what he's saying is he's going to put directions on how to build this thing on that tape so everybody will know how to build it.
That's right. And you know what? This gentleman right here, right now, knows the answer.
He's just got to make it.
He's close to it.
Just build it. I don't care whether you build it on an aluminum disc, on a piece of wood, it'll do the same thing.
Who is this? Is this John talking?
Yes.
That's John Bailey, yes.
Now, John, they have a multiple rotor where it augments the horsepower, flight power of
sure.
the unit.
Sure, they're not going to put anything on the market that would contradict all the laws.
Yeah.
All right?
Well, originally that motor came out of the Wankel Laboratories in
yes,
oh, yeah. It's similar to a Wankel, for God's sake.
Well,
the
very first one was done by E.V. Gray.
Oh, I see.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that particular motor was very efficient, although each time the physicists and the scientists went to test it, the dynamometer was always broken. Okay?
Yes.
Now E.V. Gray sits there with a motor, and it goes nowhere.
Oh, I see.
Right. Ronald Reagan gave the man an award for that patent.
Okay.
In conservation of energy. Yes, he did.
Gee.
And that motor, to this day, is still sitting in a back shelf somewhere.
Can you imagine that? And that's our solution to the auto engine.
Well, how would our scientists feel if all of a sudden one of these motors became very practical to me and you? What would they say? What excuse would they come up with?
Oh, boy.
It's a formidable question because for a while, Hitachi was going to put that motor in the Mazda automobile.
That's right. 45 horsepower.
A little 45 horsepower motor. Now, it would gain energy going downhill. It would use a little going uphill, and you'd have to charge it about once a week.
But nothing compared to what an electric car would use.
That's right.
You know, there's an old saying, it would make cars cheaper. But the extension cord would cost a lot.
They just raised the price of the batteries to $2,000 each.
Yeah, I see.
But now you don't even need the extension cord. Okay, Tom.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. You're certainly on it. Now make the motor.
Okay.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open mind.
Good. I'm wondering what consideration has been given to the economic structure of this country. There are so many corporations involved in energy production and energy use, of course. And so many jobs dependent on them. Could there conceivably be more jobs generated? And in this transition, if it could occur, it's of such great magnitude, how can we avoid chaos?
Well, very easy. We've got chaos right now, so we're going to get rid of the chaos.
True, but can you...
Whenever you consider, Marie, that most of the dollars that you spend right now are for energy, that's chaotic. I mean, you spend more money for energy than you do for food. You spend more money for energy than for taxes or anything else. And it's that's chaos in your own personal life.
Well, much of it has generated the great debt we have in this country.
Oh, the debt was created out of air, so I wouldn't really worry about that. You know, we have a system over here where we let some private bankers create money out of the air and give us the great ability to pay them back with real wealth plus interest. So don't worry yourself about that. We'll get rid of that.
With inflated dollars.
But as far as the economics of the country is concerned, one of the things that will right the economics of this country is for you to be able to keep the wealth that you have and spend it on real things rather than on energy. It's like somebody trying to charge you for the air you breathe. So the oil companies will have to change their marketing procedures.
How can they be involved in this?
What, the oil companies?
Yeah.
Right now we're burning oil in order to get energy, and of course they're polluting the planet.
Right.
We should be using those oil products to make fertile lands, or arid lands fertile again.
And other products,
and
true.
There's things where there'll always be need for petroleum products. They'll have to change their marketing techniques. As far as, you know, the biggest industry, I guess, in the country is the utilities. If you can make a free energy device for your home, you can certainly make a big one for the utilities. So they won't be polluting the air as they provide electricity. The transitional changes certainly will probably be a little tough on some people as we go into this new age of energy. But we have to remember that progress goes on. There was a, as we've talked about on the show before, Marie, there was a great industrialist whose efforts and the output of his corporation really caused America to be. Without him and his his thing, well, no, it wasn't Ford.
No.
We wouldn't have had the West. But one day, Mr. Studebaker had to stop making wagons and start making cars. And so we're going to have to, we're into that. We can't hang on to the old because there's a great economic structure built upon the old.
How can this be, though? How can we make this change?
Just put it on the market.
Is it going to be on the market?
It's not a step input. For example, if you produced right now, for example, suppose you had available a real cheap motor, let's say, by cheap I mean something that would be $5,000.
Yeah.
That would power your home. Let's take that as a given. Let's say you could do that. $5,000 or $7,000, somewhere in there, looks like about the kind of price that you could at least start delivering the first ones for. There are lots of people that are not going to be able to afford $7,000 cash. And it's going to take a long time to actually power a significant number of homes. But eventually, after a period of, you know, 2-3 years, whatever, a significant number of homes will be powered by these. But still, a significant number of people will still be using the power company. Only now, there'll be assemblies of units in the power companies furnishing the power at maintenance cost of the system plus a fair profit. It won't be at all the kind of inflated prices we're paying for energy right now, and you won't put the power companies out of business.
Well, that's
it. Will certainly redirect a lot of things. Transportation will get cheaper, so more people will travel. A lot of people would fly right now a lot more if they could afford to fly. People fly as little as they do because the price is too high, and the seats are uncomfortable, and a whole bunch of other things, but what I mean is the system adjusts, and as everybody's standard would go up is what really would happen. You wouldn't have wholesale losses of people and the standards stay the same. What really would happen is the standard of living of everybody would go on up gradually year after year as this market slowly got filled, and it would take 20 years. If you could go into production day and night with huge factories cranking it out, it'd take 20 years before you could even fill the backlog. And you wouldn't have a wholesale instantaneous change. You would have a gradual... a shift in what people do and what kind of markets they have, but yet not a catastrophic change.
Well, you got to remember also. You got to remember also, Marie, that they first started electrifying the United States around the turn of the century after Mr. Tesla gave us the alternating current.
True.
But by World War II, only 22% of the country was electrified. And it took World War II to get the whole country electrified.
So
it took a long time.
How soon could a device like this be installed in my home, say?
We hope within a year.
After the date that somebody
within a year?
Enough to go ahead and do the final development of the production engineered product.
Now, would this be able to heat the water, heat the house,
everything,
keep all the appliances running?
That's correct.
Everything and then some.
We're talking
sounds
about
like
a 15 to 20 kW unit.
Well, it sounds utopian to me because I just got my electric bill today, Marie. It was $456.
I've had to sit down before I opened some of mine.
And I used less electricity than I did a year ago. That's also on the bill.
Yeah.
And I've never seen such a high electric bill. And I have a small house. I mean, I don't live in any big mansion.
But
yeah.
You can
it's
leave
a standard little
old
cracked house out in the valley. That's $225 a month for electricity.
It's too much.
Well, it's not necessary, and so those things are going to be done. One other thing that should be brought to your attention, and we've discussed this with the League of Public Utilities, they look upon it as a boon, because as these devices start getting used in the homes, the first thing that utilities are going to see is a lessening of their demand curve, which means that they're not going to have to go out there quite as quickly or if all and go through this capital formation, which is very, very expensive to build these multi-billion dollar nuclear facilities. And that will save the stockholders a great deal of money as well as all of us. So there is really nothing but pluses and bonuses in there.
Well, what is standing in our way?
Development money?
Development money. How much would it take?
Billions.
Billions? Well, we're spending
To put the first product on the market, production engineer it with the smallest team you could get to do it, you're talking about a minimum of about $3 million. Any way you price it out, that's the smallest way you could do it. When you spend the money to do it, that's what it comes out at. A more reasonable figure, to try to figure that you don't hit everything exactly the first time you do it, that you do have some shifting around, which always occurs in research. You never have everything go perfect in research. You got to do some fiddling in research. To take a more reasonable thing into account, you need $5 to $7 million. That's what you need. And there's about four or five different inventors in the country today that, given that kind of money, could deliver or have a very high probability of delivering within 1 year a production engineered product that would power the average home.
And you're talking about the development of a prototype and not one that would be marketable.
No, I'm talking about doing the full production engineering. It can be done in a year if you really get after it. If you want to play real safe on that, give it 18 months. Give it another 6 months, and yeah, it's ready to go into production at that time. So if you want to play conservative, and that's a good thing to do with something like this, say 18 months and $7 million, and you can do it.
But to answer your question, Marie, the economy will be far better off, because it always is better off when you've got more money in your pocket.
Have you approached any of the congressmen, the senators on this?
Yes, indeed.
And are they intelligent enough to see the good in it?
No, they're not.
I was afraid of that.
The problem, Marie, is
they can't see the forest through the trees.
The problem we're talking about is insidious. Almost the entire orthodox scientific community immediately fires out the idea you cannot violate conservation of energy. And you cannot violate conservation of energy as long as you don't do what we're saying, curve space-time locally. And all our university students and all our professors have been taught that you cannot engineer general relativity at all. It's not engineerable. It's unthinkable. It's heresy to even mention that. Well, you know, somebody, a scientist, is supposed to be a heretic as far as fixed ideas.
True.
And so what we need is, we need the universities to not be so staid, but to be a little bit more heretical as far as maybe you can engineer general relativity, because nobody's ever tried. And what we're saying is you can do it, and this is a way to do it, and you ought to try it. We're throwing down that challenge to the universities. We've told you exactly how to do it. We've told you exactly where to check to see that if you do that, you can violate all these conservation laws. Just read Misner, Wheeler, and Thorne, Gravitation, and they'll tell you you could if you could do that. Read that book to see what the assumptions are in the orthodox limited general relativity that's taught. Remove the limitations and see where you are. And do the electromagnetics like we've said. Do the experiments yourself. Don't take our word for anything. Do it yourself in your own labs and in your own universities. Then come back and tell us what results you got.
One other thing, Marie, you got to keep in mind. You were talking about Washington and the politics and the politicians. The politicians are quite well aware of the fact, the state of California and also on the national level, that the greatest profiteer of the sale of energy is the government. And if you start taking away the revenues that they get from selling energy sources, you really start hanging the heart of a politician.
Well, that's our greatest problem, isn't it?
Sure is. But there's a way over it, and it'll
Bill,
be done.
Bill, can I interject one thing?
Yeah.
It's not to be hypocritical about the whole thing. Don't cry that you have not had the answers in front of you, and then 3 weeks later come back and say it can't be done. In other words, I am saying to all the people out there, I've heard you cry about where is the energy, and yet you turn out to be big hypocrites when it's right in front of you.
Seem to like to pay those big electric.
Well, I'm not condemning the whole nation. I am just condemning. You can squawk all you want about high-paid utility bills, but you have the choice right now to do something about it. Now, you have that choice. Do something with the choice.
I'd be delighted to do something tomorrow.
Well, write letters.
I tell you,
get Joe Newman his patent, and you'll crack the door wide open.
A bill has been introduced to the House of Representatives by Congressman Burton of Ohio.
Burton?
And he is, the bill is to give Joe Newman his patent. Congress can grant patents if the patent office won't. They've done it on one other occasion. The bill also calls for an investigation of the patent office, which will not give the patent to Joe Newman, even though they know that his free energy device works.
The device works. His book is on the market. Anybody who reads that book should be able to make that device, or at least prove in principle to himself that this can be done.
Now, we don't know whether the fact that the commissioner of the patent office is a one-time oil executive has anything to do with it or not. That may just be a coincidence. But nevertheless, a congressional investigation has been called for in Congressman Burton's bill, and a congressional patent given to Joe Newman, and I hope they do.
One more point that I'd like to make, Bill. You see, if funding does not occur for this type of project, what these industrialists may find out is every garage mechanic in the world will have one. Then they no longer need them. They don't have to borrow any money.
Well,
okay?
That would be their comeuppance, wouldn't it?
What I am basically saying is these devices are so simple that, like I've said before, you can stand in front of a forest and not see the trees.
Well, the thinking that has to go into them is awfully complicated, but the actual device itself gets far simpler than anything we normally build, which is why we can't understand it.
That's right.
Well, now, these devices could be produced now?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, that would generate a lot of jobs, too, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. As everything that ups, that decreases sunk costs, things that are just burned up and thrown away and lost, you might say the money is burned up.
That's
everything
true.
That quits burning up your money gives you more money to have yourself and raises your standard of living. And as everybody's standard goes up, it's a multiplying factor. It goes up more than just a linear amount. It goes up exponentially. And so what you would do is you would start freeing everybody economically. You really don't have freedom unless you're economically free.
No,
we're
truly...
are not economically free.
Right. We're truly tied to the Far East, to the Middle
East. Well, it's even worse right now. For example, they're setting us up like turkeys right now.
I'm ashamed of our country.
The refineries right now being exported back over to the countries in the Mideast. And what you're going to see the next time they tighten the screw on you for oil... We're not even going to have refineries enough to refine our own product. We're going to have to get the gasoline itself from abroad, not just the oil. So they're beginning to set us up for a real squeeze in the future. You can see it coming right down the line.
How can we be so short-sighted?
Sure. Well, it's deliberate. Refining in this country is now a depressed industry.
And what to add insult to injury, Marie, there is 6 times more oil in Alaska than there is in all of the Persian Gulf.
Oil is a glut on the world market, so obviously they raised the price.
It's disgraceful.
Of course it is.
But you can change that as a person. Everybody out there listening can change this as a person. It only requires the people. The people make up this freedom. If the people do not want freedom, then the people just sit back in their chair every night after work and they fall asleep.
And pay your bill every month.
That's right.
Pay the bill. You
well,
can,
then this requires letters.
You can start with the letters and the telephone calls to your congressmen and to your senators. One of them won't know what you're talking
See,
about.
We,
the other one might.
Bill, we really don't need their oil.
No, we don't.
We really don't need their oil. We don't need the politicians that we have running around creating havoc, telling us about these shortages when there's no shortage at all. I've done the experimentation, and I'm telling Radioland out there tonight, stop being so hypocritical about this and write your senators and congressmen, get Joe Newman his patent, and you'll see the door open up for your freedom.
We seriously need a breakthrough in this area. We need to break through this barrier, and the only way that can come is from the people. We have to, for example, get across to the average citizen that scientists, for example, are not magicians. They are human beings just like any other group, and they're a distribution of persons. There's some good ones and some bad ones, and there's a lot of pompous ones and all kinds of things, just like any other group you would pick out. Okay, you don't, just because something is said by a scientist doesn't necessarily make it true. So we must not raise science, for example, to the blind worship or the dogma. In other words, feel free to question a scientist. If you look at the things that scientists have pronounced, you'll find that they often change every few years. And so don't take science as being absolutely, positively having ultimate truth. Science does not produce ultimate truth. It produces a good kind of truth, but it's not ultimate. So don't deify them. They are human beings, and their knowledge is imperfect.
You know, also, Marie, you might put pressure with your letters and telephone calls to places like Caltech and UCLA, USC, and the aerospace industries around here and say, why don't you investigate this? Now, they'll probably send you a letter back if they do and say it's impossible.
Well, what you do is you ask them a specific question. Ask them how many experiments they've done in this area and to please report to you the results of those experiments.
And, of course, they have done none. But they will tell you that it's impossible based upon that great data and research that they have done, which is zip.
One more point, Bill, here, that if you get the Joe Newman book on his free energy machine, you will find hundreds of letters at the back of that book where Joe Newman actually wrote the president, four presidents to be exact. They never viewed the tape. They never viewed the information. They just sent him one big excuse after another, backwards and forwards.
Well, that's disgraceful.
Well,
I could see that with this kind of device, we Americans can gain our self-respect.
That's correct.
Right. That's exactly what you want.
And you can gain a great big portion of something you're losing every day, and that's your individual freedom.
True. Well, I thank you very much for all this information. It's been most interesting.
Good questions, Marie, and I appreciate you getting in here with us.
We're going to go right to work on it.
All right. Thank you, honey.
Thank you.
All right. David, you're on.
Yes, sir. Well, your show's been so interesting tonight, I don't know where to begin. I'm a first-time caller, and I hope I don't get stage fright.
Well, don't get stage fright. We're all just country boys here.
But anyway, I'm an electrician, and I dabble in real estate, and I'm kind of a amateur person in regards to science. I went to UCLA. I got a life science degree, and I agree that it's hard to get original thoughts through in the university system. For instance, I went to the physics department because I had some notions regarding gravity, and I tried to discuss it, and I was told, well, there's not been anything seriously new come up in physics in 1926, and they didn't want to listen to me. But anyway, I do have some ideas regarding gravity and light, and I just wondered if you wanted to hear about them.
Sure.
Go right ahead, but kind of make it quick. We've spent a lot of time with some of the callers here, and I want to get to as many as I can, all right?
Okay. Anyway, I've been thinking about gravity for several years now, and I wonder, I may be a little slow, but is the theory that bodies have gravitational attraction still valid?
Not in that exact sense. But what you really have as gravitational field is a warpage or a curvature of the space-time itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the position or motion of the bodies is due to, which, for example, the attraction of mass is due to that curvature.
So in other words, gravity is a phenomenon of space and not necessarily intrinsic.
That's correct.
To
it's
the body.
It's a phenomenon of the curvature of space-time.
Mm-hmm. And then I had one other question regarding the speed of light that I've been thinking about for some time. Is there any thinking as to what it is that affects the speed of light? Why is it so universal in the electromagnetic transmission?
Well, it varies, you know.
It does vary?
It does vary. For example, on the surface of the Earth, the Russians are quite aware and have published in the literature that the speed of light in a hard vacuum on the surface of the Earth is a little faster
than the speed of light in a hard vacuum away from the Earth. And that's due to the fact that all the charged particles in the Earth, the charge increases the potential, or it curves space-time a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at vacuum as nothing but a massless charge, and it says that you've got a little denser vacuum, if I can corrupt the term here. And just like sound moving faster in a denser medium, the light waves move a little bit faster. In the fourth decimal, they move that much faster on the near the surface of the Earth. And that is established experimentally.
And is gravity in some way related to the speed of light?
Well, it's certainly related to the change in the speed of light. If you curve space-time, the speed C is not necessarily the same speed it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the real thing that C represents, it's a limitation on the movement of mass. Mass can approach a certain value. You know, it can approach theoretically as close as you want to get to it, but can't exceed it. That's really what it says. There are certain things that already move faster than the speed of light. For example, the De Broglie waves, which do produce real physical effects, and the man was given the Nobel Prize for discovering that, Louis de Broglie. De Broglie waves themselves always move faster than the speed of light, or the slowest they can ever go is at the speed of light, but they're always faster than the speed of light. And since they produce real effects, they can't be ignored. So there are things that move faster than the speed of light already in physics.
Yes.
So when anyone comes in and naively says you cannot exceed the speed of light, that's foolishness.
And what are your thinkings on inertia? Is it
as far as I'm concerned, inertia is an aspect of mass, and mass is nothing but a trapped scalar resonance, trapped by the spin of the particle or whatever that makes up the mass. And so you can increase the mass of an object if you increase the amplitude of that scalar resonance, and you can decrease the mass and inertia of the same object if you decrease it.
And have you ever heard the notion of gravitational shadow?
Yes, I have. That goes all the way back to Lesage. I forget the century, but it's several centuries old.
It
was refuted based on a physical model that if you had a planet moving through raindrops, and they struck the front of the planet more often than the rear, the planet would decay in orbit, in other words, and so that couldn't be it.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, if you get into it in terms of quantum mechanics and you're not dealing with particles that hit and bounce off and produce momentum, a version of the Lesage model can be made to work.
And then I think perhaps one other question, there's the notion of the death spin of the...
You know what? I just noticed that our clock has stopped here in the studio. I'm thinking it's 11:25, and we're midnight. And I've got to run, and I've got to say goodnight to all of you, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. Good night to you all. Tom, we'll check with you later.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye. Hello there, this is...